Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization. With your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome to State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me, your host, Joseph Paris, and a select industry leader. Today, I welcome Brian Strobel, Vice President of Corporate Quality at Sierra Nevada Corporation and author of the upcoming book, Pursuing Excellence. Brian Strobel has been leading people in operational environments for nearly 30 years, where he served in roles from leading large-scale military operations to leading change across large companies. Brian started his career as an officer in the United States Marine Corps, where he helped keep squadrons of F/A-18 Hornets flying for the United States Armed Forces and also those of allies for 15 years. In civilian life, he worked for Harris Corporation, Northrop Grumman, and L3 Technologies, where he climbed the corporate ladder, becoming Vice President of Operations. In 2018, he took the position of Vice President of Corporate Quality at Sierra Nevada Corporation, a position he still holds today. He earned his bachelor's degree at Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania, his Master of Arts in Management at Webster University, and his Master of Science in Executive Leadership at the University of San Diego School of Business. His first book, Leading Change from Within, was published in 2015, and his second book, Pursuing Excellence, was just released in December of 2020. Welcome, Brian. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Joe. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Oh, it's really been my pleasure. You and I have been connected on LinkedIn for, you know, some years now, I believe.
Sure. We've had some good discussions back and forth and lots of agreement and a couple different things that maybe we saw things just maybe a little different.
Well, I mean, you know, nobody ever agrees 100% with another person. I mean, there's always, you know, differences in perspectives, usually based on, you know, experiences, either growing up or early on in their professional career, or even, you know, in their current situation. The one thing I find about, you know, our profession is there's no such thing as the truth. You know, there's just notions of what the truth might be, because The truth is very, very contextual, you know, at least my opinion.
Yeah. In our world, though, it seems that there are a certain select group of people that believe there's only one way to do something. And if you don't believe it that way, that it's not the right way. That just couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, that's rather challenging, isn't it?
Yeah.
So why don't you, you know, walk us down memory lane here? You know, how, you know, here you are today in a leadership role at a company. We'll get to the company in a second. But, you know, early on, you know, what indoctrinated you into, you know, being a leader?
Thanks, Joe. So I started out as an undergrad as a physics major. I was originally in a Navy program called NUPOC, Nuclear Propulsion Officer Candidate. I was going to be a Navy nuclear officer. Once I met a Marine in the dining hall at the university, that all changed. And then I signed the paperwork that evening. Next thing I found myself in Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia. And then for the next 15 years, I was part of the Marine Corps and I got indoctrinated into what I believe is one of the finest leadership institutions in the world. The Marine Corps gave me the opportunity to develop my leadership. It gave me formal training and put me into some stressful situations to let me hone my leadership and development. Got to travel the world, got to see some amazing things and do some amazing things with the people that I was in the Marine Corps with. And for 15 years, it was an absolute tremendous starting point and hallmark of my career and launching me on the path that I'm on right now.
So you went from nuclear propulsion to what in the Marine Corps?
I was an aircraft maintenance officer. So I worked with F-18 aircraft and I did my entire career doing such as that to include, I guess the highlight of that career would have been, I did an exchange tour a little over 2 years with the Royal Australian Air Force, joined an Australian Air Force unit and was managing the maintenance and the flight line operations for an F-18 squadron in Australia.
Awesome. That's awesome. I didn't know that. So you were in there 15 years. You decided not to go for the 20, right? 20s retirement?
Yeah. They actually, when I resigned my commission, it was rejected and they said no because they thought I was making a rash decision. Most people plan for their exit over a couple years. I write about this in my book, actually. I couldn't change my environment. It was 2005, 2006 timeframe. But we had been involved in the global war on terrorism for a while. People were doing extended deployments away from home. My wife was tired of not seeing me anymore. And I resigned my commission. I had to challenge the rejection that they said I wasn't allowed. But it all worked out good for me. But I did not retire. I went ahead and decided it was time to go and do something different after that 15 years.
All right. Super. So what was that something different? Once you got out of the Marine Corps, what was the first, where did you land?
It was an odd little job as a consultant working for the Army in Huntsville, Alabama. So I left San Diego. To my wife's dismay, we left beautiful San Diego and ended up in Huntsville, Alabama. But I worked for just a year for a defense contractor working for the U.S. Army, overseeing defense contractors and their application. That then led to my first leadership position in quality. I was hired by Harris Corporation out of Florida as a quality manager. And then over the next, I was a quality manager at Harris, moved up within Harris, then moved into a higher level position at Northrop Grumman as a program quality manager there, moved up from Northrop Grumman into L3 as a quality director, and then promoted in L3 up to be a vice president of operations from my time at L3, and then moved from that position at L3 to where I'm at now, Sierra Nevada Corporation, as the vice president of corporate quality.
Now, L3 is heavy into Department of Defense, defense work, right?
Yes, sir.
And so you went from making product that was kinetic to making beer?
Sierra Nevada Corporation. We actually have shirts that say we are not the beer company.
You don't make the beer.
No. We actually make satellites and airplanes, and we deliver whole aircraft systems to our customers. But no, we are not the beer company.
When I first saw your profile, some time ago, and I saw that you're the VP at Sierra Nevada, I was getting all excited because I actually do enjoy their beer.
Yeah.
But then, of course, I went to the website and it said, this is not beer. Yeah. You know, this is stuff that goes in the air.
Yeah.
And it's very fascinating.
A lot of people connect with me and they mention that I must have the coolest job in the world. And then I tell them that, making satellites and military aircraft systems is pretty cool. And they're a little disappointed, I think. I think they wanted maybe some kind of inside connection to the beer company.
That's funny. And so I would assume that you get all sorts of calls from people wanting to sell you filtration systems and things.
Yeah, like the beverage industry. It's what it is. It's fine.
That's fun. How close, just out of curiosity, how close is, in proximity is Sierra Nevada Corp to Sierra Nevada, the beer company?
I don't know. I don't even think it's here. We're in Reno. Now, the thing is, we're on it. I don't know if you've ever been, if you've seen the Sierra Nevada, but it is just a beautiful mountain range. And here, everything has Sierra Nevada in its name. I mean, there are so many companies that are named Sierra Nevada. We're Sierra Nevada Corporation. It's a private multi-billion-dollar company. But in this area, it's just such a beautiful thing, the Sierra Nevada mountains that everybody kind of uses that name in some capacity in this general area. So it's a common name that people absorb.
Yeah, I had a conference in Reno several years ago with the Institute of Industrial Systems Engineers, and I flew into San Francisco, and then we drove across Donner Pass down into Reno, and then we took another trip down to what's the famous lake there? I forget the lake.
Lake Tahoe.
Geez, I can't believe it. Past the Ponderosa, down to Carson City, I think it was, and up. It was a nice nice day drive. So
that was a spring or summer conference, I assume you went to, right?
Yeah, that was late spring, like late May, but there was still snow, you know, on the way to Tahoe. There was, you know, some tons of snow. Yeah. Amazing.
Winter time crossing through the Donner Pass is, you know, is something that some days it's just impossible, right? Because we do get a lot of snow.
Yeah. For the Donner party, it was impossible.
Yeah, they didn't do well.
They didn't do well. Yeah. So you've been at the Sierra Nevada Corp for how long now?
Just about 2.5 years.
And you're about ready to release your first book, correct? This is Pursuing Excellence.
No, sir. This will be my second book. So my first book.
Okay.
Yes, sir. It was my first book was called Leading Change from Within. Uh-huh. It was a book on change management about focusing on middle managers in our organizations. So this is actually my second book.
Okay.
I published one in 2015. Yeah.
2015. So the first one was in 2015. And did you use the same publisher or how?
Oh, I was with Westbo Press for Leading Change from Within. And the idea for this book came at me at the very end of that book. So I started actually working on this one at that point. But I also set out, I wanted a smaller, shorter read. So the book intentionally was designed to be under 200 pages. Mm-hmm. And I also set out, I wanted a traditional publisher. So I was focusing on the traditional publishing houses and then I'm being able to secure that with Routledge with my latest book.
Super. So I'm going to take you into Dr. Whoopi's Wayback Machine here to your first book.
Yeah.
Because I think that once you've written one book, it's easier to write the second one. There's differences, but you know, motivation for, you know, for you to wake up one day and say, I'm going to write a book. All right. A major step. I mean, a lot of people actually say it. I mean, lots of people say it. Some people dream it. Some people say it. Very few do it. So what motivated you to write your first book?
So I have two master's degrees. I have a master's degree in management and a master's of science in executive leadership. And both of those, you know, were anywhere from 2 to 3 years of intensive study. I learned more from writing both books, hands down, from either one of those master's degrees, from the amount of research that you do, the amount of just the way it organizes your thoughts in your head and makes you go out and become a subject matter expert in a particular area, just tremendous. And so when I set out to do that for the first book, it wasn't because, you know, I wanted to gain that knowledge. I didn't realize what would be involved and how long it would actually take. And then just the whole process, I felt there was a better way to manage change within organizations. What I thought was that too many companies bring in external consultants and rely completely on them. And then whenever they do great work, but then whenever they're gone, nothing is sustained, right? So I thought we need to teach our people to fish, and the middle managers are so important to our organization's success that I really wanted to focus on what can we do to improve our middle managers to make their work life better and how they can be add more value to the company. So that was my really driving factor on that first book to drive that message home.
Okay. So how long did that first book take from the moment you said, I'm writing a book, to the moment it was on the shelves? How long did that take?
Yeah, I see some people post on LinkedIn. They talk about, I started writing a book, and they talk about writing 5,000 words a day, and then they think they have a book written in like 60 days. It took me probably the biggest part of 3 years from the putting pen to paper until I was actually done with it. And then the publisher time is something different, but there was probably 3 years involved. I started it in 2012, and then in early 2012, and then it was published in 2015.
Yeah, same here with when I wrote my book. From the moment I said, you know, I'm writing a book, to the moment it was on the shelves, was about 3 years time frame.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of effort, and it, you know, creates a lot of conflict within yourself. It's like, you know, you write those 5,000 words a day, and that's a really good day. If you could get 5,000 words down in a day, that's pretty darn good. The next day, you're like, oh, 3,000 of those words were crap. So you like get rid of them. And it was It was like walking up a hill of sand, wasn't it?
Yeah, my intent with what with this new book, I keep it under 200 pages. What's the? I don't think it was from Abraham Lincoln, but there's a quote of, if I had more time, I would have written you a shorter note, right? Because if it actually to be concise and to deliver your message, but to not be overly verbose and wordy, to be able to do that concisely is takes some work, and it takes a lot of hard thought and organizing our thoughts. I'm sure you came up with ideas where when you first thought about something, here's a particular belief you had about the way things are done. But as you were writing the book and you researched it and you were organizing your thoughts within your writing, you maybe ended up changing some of your beliefs about that and how the best way to do it. I had so much learning through writing both books. It was amazing.
Yeah. And I think it's funny that even after I've written my book, and I'm sure it's the same with you, you've evolved your thoughts even further. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily that I've disagreed with anything I've written in the past. Maybe we'll call it nuanced changes, but you know, it's just the body of knowledge is ever growing, isn't it? And you know, we're just contributing to that body of knowledge.
Yep.
So your book, you know, Pursuing Excellence. Why did you write it? You wrote one book, and you said at the very end of that, you said, I had an idea for another book, and the one, the ink wasn't dry on the first, and you're starting on the second.
It wasn't. So I have a subchapter in the end of, that I wrote at the very end, literally, in the end of Leading Change from Within, and I wrote a subchapter on operational excellence. And actually, your definition at that time in 2015, your promulgated definition for operational excellence was like, and I think it still is, I think it's the standard that most people use, right? And they'll change it around and stuff to make it their own or how it fits in with their system. But I started doing research on operational excellence because I realized that's really what it's all about. Why do we want to lead change better within our organizations? And why do we want to do things better? Because we're trying to find, seek this state of improved readiness, right? So as I wrote that final subchapter, I actually put the words in there. Back in 2015, I wrote my next book will be on this concept of operational excellence. So I wrote it. I waited about, I don't know, maybe 3 months just. And then I started framing out the outline, right? So in some point in 2016, I framed out the outline and I got serious about it in 2017 and actually writing the next book.
It's interesting. You know, after I published my first book, it's, you know, just on the shelf. And people were asking me, when are you going to write your second book? Now, you know, writing a book is very exhausting. And there it is. And all I could imagine, now I can't, you know, I could only imagine giving birth to a child, of course, because I anatomically can't do that. But, you know, I could imagine a new mother holding her new infant in her arms and saying, what a beautiful infant. When are you going to have another? Okay, now she's just given birth. Okay, this could not have been an enjoyable experience. And probably the last thing she wants to hear is, when are you going to have another? But, you know, months or maybe a year or two pass, and you start forgetting the pain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you just are looking at the outcome and the satisfaction of that outcome. Yeah. And then the whole idea of a second might not seem so, well, out of place. So you put it aside for a couple of months, and then you started outlining it, and then you started in earnest writing it. Who was the audience for this second book, Pursuing Excellence?
Yeah. So the first book was middle managers, right? That's absolutely who I was focusing on. This one, as I had the work finished, I actually had a focus group of some industry experts, so from professional peers that I had. I had a focus group of about 15 people, and I let them review an outline and my proposed cover and the proposed back section of the book. And that focus group really helped me focus some of my words, because one of their questions were, they weren't sure who I was intending as a target audience. So I actually included it on the back cover to make it clear, right? But this book is for the people who lead our companies, right? It is absolutely intended for at the top of the top, right? For the CEOs, the CFOs, the C-suite level, the entrepreneurs that are running their own company, the presidents of organizations, the senior leaders within companies, because what I write about are not how to do these things. I don't go in and say, here's how you go do this, because I think people are smart and they don't need to be told. I've had people argue with me, but I don't think people need to be told how to do something. I consistently write about how we think about these things, right? So that, and I challenge people to have new thoughts and new ideas. And while that's great, bottoms up change, if I would be addressing it to the professionals and the workforce, the people who really need to have the new ideas and to open their thought processes to think about things differently are those at the top. And that's who I focus this book on.
Okay, except so senior leaders is your audience.
Yeah, senior leaders of the company, except for one chapter. The chapter on people is written for the people within the organization, but the rest of the book is written towards senior leaders.
Okay. So what problem or what opportunity, I'll summarize both of those and just call it a challenge. What challenge do these senior leaders have that this book helps to address or alleviate even?
Yeah. What I think the problem that I help solve is our efforts to transform business, they've been fleeting. We come in, we either hire consultants or we bring in new continuous improvement initiatives, and they might achieve success for a short period of time. But then once our focus comes off of it, they fizzle out and then we're kind of back to where we were before. I write about it as being average. We reinforce and we have this comfort with being average. I think average actually becomes a learned behavior that we just become comfortable with it. And to be blunt, comfortable with mediocrity. We need to become uncomfortable with it. We need to unlearn some things. And I write about how we can do those and how we can think about these things so that our transformation efforts sustain and they help move us from average to excellent.
But if somebody's complacent, somebody's lazy, whether it's a senior leader or a junior leader, how do you inspire them and get them unlazy?
Yeah. So I another thing I write about is Katz's management model from 1955. And we all were exposed to this in our undergrad management studies. And it's the familiar, it's the box with the diagonals across of it. And it shows the focus of how people focus their energy in a management from frontline leaders to middle management to senior leaders based upon conceptual for the top leaders, people skills for the middle level, and then the tactical skills for the frontline leaders. The gap exists that frontline leaders focus their energy and their thought processes only on the tactical, and top level management focus on the conceptual. So how do they connect between them? What I write about is how to open up their thought process and to consider where they came from for the top level leaders and for the frontline managers to realize and appreciate the conceptual world and the thought processes of senior leaders to help make those briefs more effective between that so they can learn from each other and they can move together towards a consolidated path on a path to excellence.
So You're asking people to really change their mindset. And, you know, one of the biggest things that I have, have a problem with or challenge with is that it's very, very difficult to get somebody to abandon a set of beliefs and habits for another. So, you know, I think about the Cold War and we used to talk about the Russians defecting to the West. And when somebody would defect, whether it's a ballet dancer or a musician or a scientist or whatever, when they defected, they said, I don't believe everything that I knew. And I'm giving that up for a dramatically, diametrically opposed way forward. How do we do that? How do we do that within a business? If we're in a business that has a culture of complacency, they're fat and happy, and the corporate world is has a funeral pyre of companies that have become that. You know, think about Kodak, and you think about BlackBerry or Research in Motion, as they were called. You know, these companies became complacent, and somebody else ate their lunch. So how do we blow up a company to get them off the nut and start changing and doing the needful?
Unlearning. Okay. And I know you've heard that term, and it's, you know, people have their different perceptions of it. I take it back to, once again, with my first book being on change, and so much of this, and how what I'm talking about is moving a company from average to excellence. And that's a heck of a lot of change, right? But how do you do that? How do you do exactly what you were discussing about? How do you get them to unlearn what they believe to be true? Kurt Lewin, who's the father of plan change, has the basic change model of unfreeze, move, freeze. So you have to unfreeze the way things are done before you move them to a new state, and then you freeze them into that new state so that you realize the improvements. That unfreeze is the most important and critical step. Lewin referred to it as disconfirmation. You need to people to disconfirm what they believe to be true. And that's unlearning. And it goes to the values and beliefs. You know, the subtitle for my book is a values-based systems approach to help companies become more resilient. The values, we have to change the way people think. We don't change the way they think until we change what they believe. So it's actually addressing it at the root cause of how we think within organizations, what we believe to be true. And they have to have new experiences to believe that different ways of doing things are in fact possible and will return greater results. So it comes back to that very root at the very beginning, our values and beliefs, what we believe to be true, and to realize that different things are in fact possible. And so we have to provide, as leaders, we have to provide a safe environment for them to be able to think things differently and to be able to realize that new results are possible if we just change our perceptions and our beliefs on how something is accomplished.
I think there's a little bit of a contradiction in what you just shared. I don't know that we can change somebody else's beliefs. I think only they can change their beliefs. We can only create an environment in which those beliefs can be changed from within. Just like I can't make you happy. You know what I mean? You're either going to be happy or you're not going to be happy. That opportunity for you to realize happiness has to come from within. Wouldn't you think, or no?
There's core beliefs. It is, and I also discussed this, it's beyond the ethical dimensions. If you try to change somebody's core beliefs, that's unethical. And that gets into brainwashing and all kinds of other things. That's a completely separate category. I'm talking about those beliefs we have in the workplace that are based upon the experiences we have. So in other words, if we reward bad behavior in companies, right? And employees see that, they're going to have that experience of seeing bad behavior rewarded. And then they're going to form beliefs that bad behavior is what's rewarded. So it's okay within this company. Yeah. So we need to stop. As leaders, we need to instill the experiences that the employees have, stop rewarding that bad behavior. And maybe it's that steady compliance to doing things the right way. Once we get in and reward that and recognize those employees for what they're doing, they will form new beliefs that management actually favors this behavior over that. So we can influence them. And it's the things right. We have to do to help drive those new experiences.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure that everybody's going to enjoy reading your book. I just have a couple of quickie questions here. I usually ask them, of all of my the people that I have conversations with. What's the best piece of advice you ever received?
Marshall Goldsmith. I've worked with Marshall on several different projects, and I've listened to him speak at different events, and I participated in some sessions with him. And Marshall likes to talk about be okay with those things that you cannot change, right? So we can't change everything. We have to accept some things for how they are, and rather than put energy into something that is not solvable or a person's behavior that you cannot adjust, You need to learn to be okay with it and be able to move on, because your energy can be used in other places rather than staying stuck on something that you absolutely cannot change.
Right, right, right. Excellent. And who is one person that you admire and why?
So remember I mentioned that I had done the foreign exchange tour with the Royal Australian Air Force.
Yeah.
So when I was in Australia, I was working, the commanding officer I was working for, his name is Jeff Brown. And a typical Australian personality, very low key, but also very large personality. And he was just the strongest leader that I ever worked for. For his send off, whenever he retired from the Air Force, the typical event that you do is a large flyover for the pilot, and the pilot participates in a flyover of, you get every available aircraft and you do a formation flyover. We challenged our maintenance team. We made a lot of improvements and we got every single one of our jets ready for that. When he walked to, and the pilots have to sign a logbook before that reviews all of the information and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they have to, you know, check the maintenance history of the aircraft. So we had 21 pilots lined up and they were all signing their logbooks at the same time. And he's flipping through them and he's talking to me while he's flipping through the pages. And I said, sir, you're not reading about the previous gripes. And he looks at me and he says, Brian, he goes, I just do this so my younger pilots see that I care, but I trust you completely, right? So he wasn't even looking at the information because he formulated that trust in me. So we had a send off. He retired. It was 1999. He went and he was selling real estate in the Gold Coast of Australia. I moved back to the States and I was working for the Commander Naval Air Forces of the Atlantic Fleet. And then 19 terrorists hijacked four airplanes and, you know, brought their war to America and to the world. He came out of retirement, Jeff Brown, from selling real estate to eventually rise up through the ranks to be in charge of the entire Royal Australian Air Force as chief of Air Force, based upon the others recognized too. His leadership was just impeccable. So even though I had such a strong background, I worked for some tremendous leaders here within the States. The one who I still think of as the one I want to model and emulate is Jeff Brown, the Australian Air Force officer.
Amazing. That's an amazing story. Thanks for sharing that, Brian. So you've been listening to another episode of State of Readiness. My guest today has been Brian Stovall, and his book is Pursuing Excellence. When's it going to hit the shelves there, Brian?
So it's available now. It's a 2021 date. You can order it now. Hard copies already on backlog on Amazon. They've already sold out of their initial lots. The soft copy, the paperback, is selling still right now, but it's available now. It should be on the shelves, though, after the first of the year, for sure.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for joining me today, Brian. I'm sure that the audience has enjoyed your story, and much success to you.
Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.